welcome to episode 3 of this third season of Idiom America. In the first two seasons, I took a look at presidential idioms, or idioms that originated or were popularized by U.S. presidents, including some pretty famous ones like nip it in the bud, worth his salt, keep the ball rolling, twiddling one's thumbs, house divided, kid gloves, and of course that idiom nonpareil, okay. The attention that's given to U.S. presidents and the campaigns and media circuses that surround them make for fertile soil for some colorful language. And I ended off this series with the youngest man to ever become president at age 43, the 26th president, one of my very favorite presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, who was in office from 1901 to 1909. And I haven't gotten back to this series yet, partly because Teddy and his bully pulpit are a pretty hard act to follow. Robert Taft certainly found Teddy a tough act to follow. Taft's well known for being a gifted lawyer and judge, who before his presidency served as the U.S. Solicitor General, the person who argues on behalf of the federal government before the Supreme Court, as well as a judge on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And then after his presidency, he of course went on to become Chief Justice on the Supreme Court. But he was also a talented administrator. In episode 1 of this season, we talked about the boondocks, or the boonies, and how that's one of those rare American idioms that comes out of the Philippines and the Spanish-American War there at the turn of the 20th century. Well, in the aftermath of that war, Taft was chosen to lead a commission that would help establish a civil government in the Philippines and end military rule. And in 1901, he became the first civilian governor of the Philippines. And he generally drew praise from everybody for his administration there. And he remained in the post until 1904, when Teddy Roosevelt asked him to become his Secretary of War. And then not long after, he was elected to the presidency in 1908 when Teddy didn't run. And the portly Taft was also well known for his girth. He was 6 feet tall, and his weight fluctuated from 250 to 350 pounds. And growing up, I had a book that talked a little about each president, and there was a story in there about how Taft got stuck in the White House bathtub. And for a long time, that's all I could ever really say about Taft. But it turns out that this story doesn't hold water and that there's no evidence this ever happened. But his weight did make him the target for cartoonists of the time, of course, as well as the butt of plenty of jokes in the press. Like the quip of a fellow Supreme Court justice that Taft is the politest man in Washington. The other day he gave up his seat in a streetcar to 3 ladies. And Taft, he also straddled the transition between horses and automobiles. And so there were lots of jokes about how his horse riding was cruelty to horses, such as during a debate in Congress about whether it should appropriate money to acquire automobiles for the White House, with one congressman remarking, "The incoming president, President Taft, proposes to abandon horses for reasons that the gentleman well knows. He does not wish to violate the law against cruelty to animals." But was Taft known for any idioms or any colorful use of language? I can't really find much out there, but we do get the idiom dollar diplomacy from Taft, and dollar diplomacy is a form of American foreign policy that Taft espoused that minimizes the use or threat of military force and instead advocates furthering the country's aims through the use of its economic power, such as by guaranteeing loans that made to foreign countries. And it came from a speech that Taft made to Congress in which he characterized his foreign policy programs as substituting dollars for bullets. And his critics picked up this phrase and converted it into the phrase dollar diplomacy, which was a highly uncomplimentary term to describe Taft's dealings with other countries. And you still see this term used a fair bit, and it's still used disparagingly. Taiwan uses a lot in the context of accusing China of buying off countries to recognize the People's Republic of China, capital there in Beijing, instead of Taiwan and Taipei. Back in 2012, you had 23 countries recognizing Taiwan as the true China. Today, it's only recognized by 12 countries, the majority of which are in Latin America and the Pacific. So for example, earlier this year, you had Honduras that switched from recognizing Taiwan to China, and Taiwan accusing China of engaging in dollar diplomacy by buying Honduras off with promises of lucrative investment and infrastructure funds. As an aside, China used to engage in panda diplomacy, building relations through the exchange of pandas with other countries, but that's coming to an end, it appears. From 1941 to 1984, China just gave other countries pandas. And then, starting in 1984, it began to lease them instead of gifting. Recently, though, it started a policy that some have called punitive panda diplomacy, and it's pulling back all its pandas from Western zoos as the lease agreements end in retaliation for what China sees as unfriendly stances. I don't know, it all seems kind of petty to me, but what do I know, other than that I will be sad to see the pandas here at DC Zoo go, as China's refused to renew the lease and has taken them back in December. But dollar diplomacy is about it for Taft that I can find as far as the coinage of new words or phrases goes. And then in 1912, Teddy Roosevelt ran against Taft for the Republican presidential nomination. And then when Taft won the Republican ticket, Roosevelt formed the Progressive Party, or the Bull Moose Party, as some called it, which effectively guaranteed that Democrat Woodrow Wilson would be elected president. Taft actually carried only Utah and Vermont, and he split the Republican vote with Roosevelt, which allowed Wilson to win handily. Taft at least had a good sense of humor about it, and he was reported to quip that, "Well, I have one consolation. No candidate was ever elected ex-president by such a large majority." Woodrow Wilson, in his first term, he got some consequential legislation passed, like the first federal income tax, the creation of the Federal Reserve, some more antitrust legislation, including the creation of the Federal Trade Commission to prohibit unfair business practices, laws banning child labor and limiting railroad workers to an 8-hour workday. And he got reelected in 1916, partly because of this legislation, but maybe even more so from his slogan, which was, "He kept us out of war." But by 1917, he concluded the U.S. couldn't remain neutral in World War I, and he asked Congress for a declaration of war on Germany. And then after the war, he tried to build an enduring peace by advocating for the League of Nations, precursor to the United Nations, of course. And Wilson, he was also a more freewheeling user of language, and he actually got criticized in the press for using too much slang or being too informal with language. But that means that we do get some more linguistic innovation from him than we do from Taft, such as the term America First, which refers to a policy stance in the U.S. that generally emphasizes American exceptionalism and non-interventionism. Some critics have called it America Alone. And in recent times, this term is, of course, associated with Donald Trump, who used it all the time. And America First was actually the official foreign policy doctrine of his administration. But it was Woodrow Wilson who coined the term in 1915 in his bid to keep America neutral in World War I. And since then, it's had a pretty controversial usage. The KKK, in their peak in the 1920s, used the phrase, and it was known as the slogan in the foreign policy advocated by the America First Committee, which was a group that had 800,000 dues-paying members back in the day that was against the American entry into World War II. There's a cartoon from Dr. Seuss, 1941, in which a mother's sitting in a big overstuffed chair with America First emblazoned on her chest as she reads to her kids snuggled up close to her from a book of fables called Adolf the Wolf. "And the wolf chewed up the children and spit out their bones. But those were foreign children, and it really didn't matter." It's safe to say that the term America First has often been associated with racism, and sadly it seems Wilson was no exception, as he's now widely recognized as personally holding racist views. And as the first Southerner to ascend to the presidency since the Civil War, he brought with him a segregationist ideology and a sympathy for the Lost Cause narrative, and his administration sat about trying to actively segregate the federal government, and not to mention stuff like screening Birth of a Nation at the White House. And upon this screening, Wilson is reported to have remarked, "It's like writing history with lightning. My only regret is that it is all so terribly true." It's highly disputed whether he ever said this, but unfortunate endorsement of a grossly racist film aside, it is a colorful way to describe the impact that the new medium of film would have on recording and creating history, that writing history with lightning. And it brings to mind another lightning idiom, to catch lightning in the bottle, and its companion, bottled lightning. And the primary meaning of this one is to succeed in a way that is very lucky or unlikely. She caught lightning in a bottle with the success of her very first book. And this one often suggests that the success is bound to be fleeting as well. There are other meanings to this one that vary a little bit. One refers to some kind of ephemeral atmosphere that has some special qualities, like in the early days at some tech startup or some musical or artistic group where the trying to catch lightning in the bottle. Or finally, it can also mean to do something nearly impossible, seizing the extraordinary, capturing something powerful and elusive. And this idiom goes back to Benjamin Franklin and his experiments with kites and keys and lightning, where he proved the electric nature of lightning and started to collect the electricity in Leyden jars for later use. One thing we can thank Wilson for is that we no longer have to apply the definitive article "the" as an honorific before Congress. Before Wilson, no one called Congress just Congress. It had to be the Congress. And Wilson innovated by just calling it Congress, and he took a lot of flack for it. And the next three presidents actually restored the, but the dam had been cracked and the eventually fell out of use. And Wilson also came up with some neologistic aphorisms like, "A man's rootage is more important than his leafage," which hits a bit differently these days now that Wilson's racist views rooted in the South are better known. But his use of slang like "we must get a move on," and "that is going some," put him in the same class of Lincoln, and his use of terms like "sugarcoated." Critics looked at it as undignified, others as expanding the language to include some valuable idioms. All right, on to number 29, the Republican Warren G. Harding. And this guy's a goldmine for interesting linguistical variation, which is somewhat surprising because his presidency wasn't rich with much else, except scandal. But in the words of a political opponent, Harding's speeches were an army of pompous phrases moving across the landscape in search of an idea. And the takedowns got even more vicious and hilarious, like this one from H.L. Mencken in a 1921 column called "Gamalilese." The G in Warren G. Harding stood for Gamalil. "I rise to pay my small tribute to Dr. Harding, setting aside a college professor or two and a half dozen dipsomaniacal newspaper reporters. He takes the first place in my Valhalla of literati. That is to say, he writes the worst English that I have ever encountered. It reminds me of a string of wet sponges. It reminds me of tattered washing on the line. It reminds me of stale bean soup, of college yells, of dogs barking idiotically through endless nights. It is so bad that a sort of grandeur creeps into it. It drags itself out of the dark abysm of pish and crawls insanely up to the topmost pinnacle of posh. It is rumble and bumble. It is flap and doodle. It is balder and dash." And it goes on. "It is a kind of baby talk, a puerile and windblown gibberish. In sound, it is like a rehearsal by a country band, with only the bass drummer keeping time. In content, it is a vacuum." And in case you're not familiar with the word there from H.L. Mencken, dipsomaniacal, it means an uncontrollable craving for alcoholic liquors. And it's not a word you hear much these days. The venerable New York Times, however, defended Harding's style as presidential. "Mr. Harding's official style is excellent. Its merits are obvious. In the first place, it is a style that looks presidential. It contains the long words and big sentences which are expected. Furthermore, the president's style is one that radiates hopefulness and aspiration. In the president's misty language, the great majority see a reflection of their own indeterminate thoughts. But Harding himself frankly acknowledged that his speech was empty and pompous. In fact, he had a term for it, and he called it bloviation. He seemed proud of it. And we have him to thank for the word bloviate, which means to talk at length, especially in an inflated or empty way, to write or speak verbosely and windily, to pontificate by employing and engaging a plethora of grandiose lexicographical constructions of multitudinous variety while conveying merely a modest modicum of actual content. But Harding wasn't the first one to use the word bloviate. It came there from Ohio, but he certainly plucked it out of obscurity and made it mainstream. He described bloviation as the art of speaking for as long as the occasion warrants and saying nothing. And as I say, the word originated in Ohio, where Harding was from, and there it meant idle chatter. And one etymology suggests that the word is a compound of blow, in its sense of to boast, which you also find in another Americanism, blowhard. And then they added a mock Latin ending, the Aetian, to give it the self-important stature implicit in its meaning. And the height of Harding's bloviation might have come from his 1920 speech about adjusting to peace after World War I, with its no less than seven pairs of alliterating opposites. America's present need is not heroics, but healing. Not nostrums, but normalcy. Not revolution, but restoration. Not agitation, but adjustment. Not surgery, but serenity. Not the dramatic, but the dispassionate. Not experiment, but equipoise. Not submergence in internationality, but sustainment in triumphant nationality. I mean, this is crazy stuff. What does this mean? Not agitation, but adjustment. And not surgery, but serenity. Sense here, meaning, has been sacrificed for alliteration. But the alliterative pair from the speech that got the most attention was not nostrums, but normalcy. Not because of nostrum, which refers to a medicine, especially one that's not considered effective, that's prepared by an unqualified person, but because of normalcy, which pretty much means normality, the quality or condition of being normal. But it has now come to refer in particular to the normality of the general economic, political, and social conditions of a nation. And this is thanks to Harding's use here, as he coined the word in this speech pretty much. The oft-repeated story here is that Harding's prepared speech actually had the word normality, but that the candidate misread it. And then his campaign handlers, it said, decided to just really lean into it by using the word in their campaign slogan, which soon became return to normalcy. They've returned to normalcy. But it's possible that Harding actually intended to use normalcy in his speech, although normality was by far the more common usage at the time. Normalcy was not unknown, particularly in theological circles, in some of the literature, and it's possible that Harding, a devout Baptist, had been exposed to the word through some of that theological literature. But whatever the case, there's no doubt that Harding made normalcy the word it is today. And one other phrase we have to thank Harding and his love of alliteration for is founding fathers, to refer to the late 18th century American revolutionary leaders who united the 13 colonies, oversaw the War of Independence, established the U.S., created a framework of government, constitution. Although people had used the term founders and the term fathers to refer to these men, nobody had put the two together until Harding, when he used the phrase in his keynote speech at the Republican National Convention of 1916, and then later repeated the phrase at his 1921 inauguration, and it started to catch on from there. And finally, one more word that gets attributed to Harding and that maybe could be used to describe some of these words, like bloviation, normalcy, founding fathers, American first, dollar diplomacy, is Americanism. Harding's reported to have said about this twist on Wilson's American First doctrine, that I don't know much about Americanism, but it's a damn good word with which to carry an election. And the next president, Calvin Coolidge, didn't have to carry an election to become president, because Harding died of a heart attack in San Francisco only a few years into his term. And so Coolidge, as his vice president, ascended to the presidency. And surprisingly enough, there's some interesting utterances from Silent Cal, but they'll have to come in another episode, as I've bloviated enough for now. Thanks for listening.